Everyone deserves leisure, including kids. And it's okay if screens are just leisure. Everybody deserves leisure. That said, when we recognize that there could be deeper involved critical thinking going on in the entertainment games our kids like to play, we can help make those connections.
Welcome to the SensoryWise Solutions podcast for parents, where parents can get real, actionable strategies to support kids with sensory processing disorder. I'm Laura, OT and mom to Liliana, a sensory sensitive kid who inherited my anxiety and my love for all things Disney. Consider me your new OT mom bestie. I know my stuff, but I also know what it's really like in the trenches of parenting a child with sensory processing disorder.
Okay, Mom, enough about me. Let's start the podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. Today, my main objective is to normalize screen time use in whatever way works for your family. I know as parents, we are constantly bombarded by a list of shoulds and shouldn'ts and really big clickbaity headlines that really create a lot of fear and guilt among parents. You really see this for almost every childhood concern, but I see it a lot about screen time. And in 2024, we're definitely not decreasing our kids' exposures to screens. So let's lean into it a bit and really find out, do we need to stress about limiting screen time? Are there differences between the kinds of screens our kids are using? And what does this say about neurodivergent kids? And how does this change for neurodivergent families? We're going to cover all of this in today's episode, but I'm definitely not doing it alone. I have invited one of my longtime Instagram pals, Ash Brandon from The Gamer Educator. They have been a public school educator for over a decade. And in that time, they found innovative ways of using student interests, including video games, to increase engagement and make learning more fun and effective. Since February 2021, their Instagram page, The Gamer Educator, has helped tens of thousands of families make screen time beneficial for the whole family. Ash believes screens should be a part of our lives, not the center of our lives, and helps caregivers navigate the world of tech using consistent, loving boundaries. In their free time, Ash loves to hike, bake, play video games, and spend time with their family. All right, let's get into the episode. All right, here we are. Ash, it's so good to have you on the podcast. It's so good to interact with you live. I feel like I know you. You sent me a Small World popcorn bucket from Disneyland Tokyo. I have that. I'm staring at it right now in front of me. So you have a special place in my heart for going across the world and including me in your purchases at Disneyland Tokyo.
It really is a fond memory, actually. It was a fun little scavenger hunt.
And it came with some very delicious, different flavored popcorn, I remember you said. It was like...
Yes, that flavor was, it was some sort of like raspberry cheesecake kind of flavor.
I think Disneyland Tokyo has the best merchandise, and I'm always so jealous of people.
Yeah, there were some other popcorn buckets that I was beginning to totally want. Could not have fit, would not use them, but I totally get it. They were
well, I am forever grateful that you took up precious space in your luggage on the way home to bring that to me. So thank you. Well, we are not talking about Disney today. Today we are talking all things parenting and managing screen time. And I have the go-to person here with me to ask these questions and have this discussion. Ash, can you share a little bit about how you found yourself in this specific niche? Maybe what piqued your interest in it to begin with, and then how you started to create more content relating to this on Instagram and social media?
Yeah, so for people who are new to me, I'm Ash. My pronouns are they, them, and I live on Instagram at The Gamer Educator. And I'm a career educator. I teach middle school, and I've taught like pretty much everything. I started as a music teacher. I taught social studies and math, and I currently work as a librarian. So I've worn a lot of hats, and I kind of got into this space from education. I had devoted a lot of time during my master's degree to looking at the use of, or the potential use of, commercial video games in a music classroom. That was when Guitar Hero was really popular,
Oh
so I'm really aging
man.
myself.
Oh, core memories.
Yes. And after I did that research, and I really didn't find a lot of uses of it, or at least a lot of published uses of it, I decided that I wanted to try things in my classroom, not so much of like literal uses of video games, but really looking into what is it that's going on in terms of the structure of these games, like psychologically, that is so motivating. And I knew that feeling as someone who enjoyed video games myself. And so I started trying to find ways of putting that into my classroom, mostly in like structure, like curriculum structure and lesson design structure. And I liked what I found, and I kind of presented those ideas at conferences, mostly like video game centric spaces, because people were more open to that. And that was kind of it. And when the pandemic began, I realized that that part of my life was kind of on hold. I wasn't going to be going to events like that anymore. And that was just the push I needed, I think, to get online. I thought about it for a while, but just couldn't really decide if it was something I wanted to do. And that was kind of the push. And when I initially went on to Instagram, I thought, oh, it'll just be like what I'm already doing, and it'll be really centric around education and educators, because I kind of naively thought, well, parents see their kids playing games all the time. Like, they must already be fine with it. They must already like be okay and see the value in it because it's in their house all the time. And then really quickly I was like, no, that's not true.
No.
Yeah.
Yep. We've got a lot of inner
And
demons we're fighting as parents against this screen time and technology. So, yeah.
for sure. So that was when I realized, like, oh, okay, this is a different niche than I thought, and in many ways it's a lot bigger than I thought, and realized that there wasn't a voice in this space that felt realistic, I guess, or that felt there wasn't a voice in the space that seemed to consider adults in the conversation and be realistic about what the current needs and demands of parenting actually are. And I think that that has become a real central kind of tenet in what I do. And so, yeah, that's kind of how it all began, and it just kind of grew from there.
I find myself in the same place where we have a lot of research, and the research gets put out there in clickbait headlines and scares a lot of parents off. And so, but it's really something where, I want to be mindful of the research and say, okay, sure, there's research here. And we take that into consideration in terms of how it impacts development. Yet there's not a lot of research on what parenting looks like in 2023 or 2024 and how that can also impact from another perspective. And so, the practicality of things and the merging of our worlds of education, research, practical, and then like some clinical knowledge that I add to it as well is so important. So I really, really enjoy your posts where you can, where you share how we can think of screen time just as we do food, like how we can set the same boundaries around that. Could you give the audience a little example? I think it was a reel that maybe you had done over summer of how you set boundaries around screen time just as you would mealtime. Can you give us that example?
Yeah, I really do like the parallel to food, because I think food is something that a lot of like current parents realize, like, oh, maybe this is something that I want to handle a little bit differently in my parenting than what I experienced growing up. And I think that there's a lot of parallels there with technology, because for many reasons, but one of them is that it's also very different now. And we've seen a big push for a lot of neutrality around food, that there isn't good food or bad food, and that, all food and all bodies are, it can be good bodies and good food. And then it's really, putting more of that on our kids to be able to figure out what their body needs and listen to their body. And I like drawing on that parallel, because I think it helps separate the feeling of morality that often comes up with this. You know, there's not morality to food, and there also is not morality to screens. And I think a lot of adults, whether or not they're always aware of it, are actually putting a lot of moral weight on screens. And that, I think, is often their hang up, this feeling that if I, as an adult or as a caregiver, am using screen time, then that must be bad and must be a judgment or like a bad moral feeling of my parenting. Like, I must be not a very good parent if this is what I'm doing, because they could, or my kids could be doing something better. That's kind of always where we go. And that assumption that they could be doing something better is only possible if we put moral weight on the screen, and if we assume that there is like a moral weight to things we do for leisure. So in that food comparison, it's like, okay, when we are the parents serving the meal, you know, we talk about division responsibility with food, which I don't know a ton about, but I know the basic model, and it's, you know, adults decide what's served and when, and kids decide how much to eat.
Yep.
And kids also get to decide how they feel about what's served. Right.
Right.
They can complain that it's not their favorite food, and that doesn't change what we offer.
Yep.
We can say this is what's available and you don't have to eat it. We're giving them the control over listening to their body and deciding what to do with what's available. And we're also not making everything they demand of us. Right. So there is that division of responsibility and some boundaries. And similarly with technology, we can decide what's available and when. And our children can decide what they do within the screen time that's allowed. And they also can decide that they don't like what's available or how much is available or when it's no longer available. And that really is, that's their job. That's their responsibility.
I love that reframe. It makes it so much easier to understand it that way. How do you answer questions from parents when they ask things about like the research that shows that, you know, screens are associated with certain developmental concerns and challenges? I think there was a recent one that I even saw recently. I think you and I had shared this on Instagram, called, the title was Early Life Digital Media Experiences and Development of Atypical Sensory Processing. So there's lots of different research articles out there that say associated screen time use is associated with challenges in so-and-so areas. How do you help parents become critical thinkers about these pieces of research? And what's your overall takeaway from the research about screen time? And what do we actually know about it?
You know, from the kind of shortest way I can put it is that for every article, like for a lot of the studies that come out that find these like supposedly negative associations, there will almost always be a counterpiece that tends to say the opposite. And we don't always hear them equally. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. There is a recent study, not as recent as the one you're quoting, but from about 4 months ago, from the Ohio State University, that was looking specifically at excessive screen time.
I saw that one in my research. Yeah.
Yeah. It was looking at excessive screen time in preschoolers and specifically late at night, which is like also not a best practice with screens, obviously. It was looking at impacts on their academic development later in life, and I think also behavior. I can't remember for sure. And it found absolutely no association, like not even a correlation. And a lot of these studies are correlation studies, meaning X is happening and Y is happening in a similar relationship. So that study came out and found no relationship. And it was really looking at families facing oppression, marginalization, families in poverty. And what I loved about that study is that the study authors specifically called out these systems. They said, you know, if we're really concerned with excessive screen time, we need to be giving families help. We need to be giving them, you know, accessible after school or before school care and meal help and childcare help, because that is what will reduce the screen time. Demonizing the screen time will not reduce the screen time. There was another recent study that was done by a major author in this area, and it looked at thousands, might have been tens of thousands of kids and their technology use, and also did not find any significant negative outcomes in major parts of their lives. I'm not going to be more specific because I didn't read all the specifics. But yeah, the study that you mentioned, I was really interested about hearing your take on that too, because it definitely, when I read just the synopsis of it, it definitely mentioned, you know, aspects of sensory processing that, like, to me don't really mean anything. Like, I don't really know what they mean.
Sure. And I couldn't access the full PDF. Yeah, me I didn't either. Get to read it too much, but I remember before I even spent time reading it, I always look at what they're qualified, like, what did they study? And you had mentioned they were only looking at TV and DVDs, right?
Yeah, which is really weird.
Like, very limited. Yeah.
In 2023, that's pretty weird.
Yes.
But I think that's important to note, because anymore, like, if you read a headline that says screen use,
yes,
immediately, what are you going to think as a parent? You're going to think,
you're going to see the screens that you use, the exact situation.
Exactly. You're going to fill in whatever you have. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And these articles are, the articles themselves are not accessible to everybody. And even if you could get your hands on it, if you are not well versed in the literature or know how to read them, it means like nothing. Right. So then parents rely on like Good Morning America to to fill in the gaps and to summarize in a very, very watered down way where you're not getting the full context. And then we make our next decision based off of that. Right. So
and particularly with studies like this, and I would say studies like this are pretty common studies that are looking at the relationship of technology use to aspects of neurodivergence. Mm-hmm. And neurodiversity. So that in particular, like, really irks me. I'm sure it does for you too.
Yep.
Because the implication there is that there's this outside causal factor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't speak to whether that is possible with sensory processing. I know you can.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, with things like autism or ADHD, you know, environmental factors are not causing those things. And there's an absolute ableist component to talking about them in that way. And there's just such a fear-mongering component for parents, because if you have a child who seems to have difficulties with sensory processing or seems to have ADHD, if that's your reality now, no amount of torturing yourself in the past over whether or not you let them use screens, that's not going to change your reality now. And all it's going to do is make this parent feel like it's all their fault for the rest of their child's life.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't enable any, that doesn't empower anyone. And I just think that that's such a disservice to families. And I also think that idea that we're trying to find this like culprit for something that is really just the way people experience the world, there's just such an ableist component to that that really, really just bothers me.
I would love for you to explain or kind of elaborate on is, I love that part of your bio where you say that part of your mission or your belief is that screens should be part of our lives, not the center of our lives. And to help caregivers navigate the world of tech using consistent, loving boundaries. What does that look like to have screens be part of our lives and not necessarily the center of our lives?
I'm going to go back to that idea of like moral neutrality. And I think that a lot of caregivers, in an effort to make technology a minimal part of their child's life, whether or not they are aware of it, they are inadvertently, or maybe inadvertently, actually putting a lot of moral weight on technology. Because if I am trying to minimize something because I feel that it might, I don't know, be bad or not the best use of my child's time, that can easily go to a place of feeling kind of scarce, like a scarce resource for a kid. Mm-hmm. This feeling of like, oh, well, I'm not allowed this thing very much, so I really, really want it now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what I have to do to get it, so I have to try really hard, and I should try begging, and I should try crying. And then parents give in, and then the kid doesn't know when they're going to get it again, so they whine and complain and cry more. And then the parent is like, I knew it. It's the screen's fault. I shouldn't have done this. And then they restrict more. And then it's this vicious
cycle.
It just makes it worse and worse and worse. And again, a lot of that is because we are putting something on screens. We're putting this association on them, and thus we want to minimize them. And I completely understand why we do that. But you know, the reality is not all parts of our days or our child's days are the same in terms of the importance of what they do. You know, like everyone, you know, for some people, bath time is going to be more important than, you know, a meal together or whatever. Like every family is going to have these kind of different rankings of things, but we don't necessarily put like moral weight on them, right? Mm-hmm. They're just parts of our day. And when we are able to step back and just have screens be a part of our day or a part of our lives, then they become just a everyday part of life, like the other kind of mundane parts of life, like going to the playground and bath and books and whatever. And then it also becomes easier to hold boundaries around them. Because if I am thinking of this as just, oh yeah, it's time for you to have independent playtime because it's whatever time we normally have that. And then, oh yeah, now it's time for some screens while I make lunch. If those things feel just equal in terms of routine parts of our day, then if a kid has a hard time ending screens, if I'm just thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to hold the boundary around this the same way I would if they didn't want to leave the playground, then there's not this feeling of that you're feeling this way because of the screen, and that must, and therefore this is a mark on me as a caregiver, as a parent. So I think taking the morality out of it really helps keep it more neutral and also makes it easier to enforce, in my opinion.
It helps me like not second guess why I'm doing a certain boundary around it. Could you help differentiate the different kinds of screen time and maybe what that look, because I know, you know, we'll talk about difference between iPad swiping games, we'll talk about videos, we'll talk about the Switch, we'll talk about FaceTime. There's a lot of different kinds of screen time. Do you have any, what's your take on, you know, one being a more appropriate, less appropriate, like, and how do you manage that in your household and recommend others?
The only one that kind of lives on its own in terms of, you know, what like official organizations and such would say about it is like FaceTime is video chatting. Even in recommendations made by organizations, you know, they will say that even under age two, that video conferencing is okay because it is essentially the same as talking to someone in person. You know, you're having that conversation. So that kind of is its own.
It's kind of a separate thing,
that's
right?
That's kind of a separate thing. But then within this huge realm of screens, as you're saying, there's myriad different things and ways of interacting with them. And you know, this is where I think it's really important to think about and notice what effects you notice with your kids, and also to be able to think about the need that you are using screen time for. As I mentioned at the beginning, I didn't feel like people were in this space where talking about the role or needs of an adult when it comes to the use of screens. And I think that that's really, really important because the reality is screens are often filling in a need for an adult who's using the screen. And that doesn't mean we want to ignore the child in that situation. Of course we don't. But you know, if my need is I have to be in a meeting and I cannot be bothered, then you might want something that's going to like engross your child and that they might not need your help and it might keep them quiet. And so like for your kid, that might be a movie. And for another kid, that might, they might, you know, not have enough attention span because of their age or just how they are. And they might not be able to focus on a movie for more than 10 minutes. So for them, an app might work a lot better because it will keep them engrossed and engaged. And, you know, some people will say that, you know, the passive screen time, like a like TV or movies, on the one hand, it's passive. There's less movement. There's less like technical engagement.
Yeah, you're right? More like figuring zone anything out is what some people say.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it's so funny because I feel like you'll hear people say that, like, oh, it's zoning out. But then I feel like you'll also hear about apps like, oh, well, they're too fast paced. And it's like, well,
too fast paced and addicting and the dopamine hits and the sweat.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, right. There's something for everything.
Right. And it's like, okay, well, apparently, again, we can't win. So it's that feeling. But yeah, for some kids that more passive, you know, some people might feel like, oh, well, they're having to focus more. It's a longer plot. It's going to keep their body calm. Maybe that's what you need. And like I said, for others that might not work, or maybe you do want something that's going to encourage movement. Maybe you have Just Dance for the Switch because it's freezing and they can't go outside and this is how you're going to get in some movement. So I think it's important to think about what need is the screen trying to address. And then how do we incorporate that? And the other thing is, the other reason I like to take the morality out of it and really just notice things in your own household is that when I am just noticing, then I can think of the behaviors or things I might notice as just data, like it's just information. Like you were talking about with food, you know, if you noticed that a food seemed to be having some effect on your child's behavior, then you can do something about that. You can try. We're going to cut out this one snack or whatever. You can make a change. And if you notice a difference, great. And if not, oh, well, we can go back to it, right? And we do the same thing with tech. You know, if I notice that every time we try to end a certain show, it is just a giant meltdown, then, you know, if all I do is blame the show, well, that does not give me any strategies to try. It doesn't give my kid any strategies to try. It doesn't give me another way of meeting that need. And it also doesn't make, like, what am I going to do tomorrow? Right. It doesn't give me any solution. So instead, if I'm like, okay, I cannot spend 15 minutes managing their meltdown when I only got 30 minutes out of a screen to begin with. So what is one thing I can try? Right. I'm going to choose one variable that I can try, and it might be 5 minutes less or a big activity for after, or a big sensory input before or after, or moving it to a different time of day, and like choose one thing and see if it makes a difference
to change it.
And if it does, great. And if not, you can decide, are we cutting that out of our lives for a while? Or are we going to try another strategy?
I think that that idea that whatever I try can be temporary is something I always need to be reminded of with whatever thing I'm trying for myself or my daughter. I'm like, well, I'm not going to lose anything by just trying it out and seeing what happens. I also, in the same way, when I coach parents through it, I say, you know, if screen time is causing more problems than it's solving, then I agree there's something to change. It doesn't mean you need to be like a no screen household. But I'm curious if you have a certain chain of events of like what you try first, if you're trying to help parents figure out how to make screen time work for their family. Like, let's say right now, you know, if they came to you and they're like, you know what, Ash, my son is playing this game, and transitions are always hard. He's more dysregulated, yet he loves and does not stop talking about Minecraft, Roblox, whatever. How can I, what is your chain of events for adjusting certain variables before they make any complete, like, cutting things out?
That's a great question. I'm going to ruminate on this more.
Yes.
For future.
If you need it.
That's a great content idea.
For, I get the question too. And then for me, it's usually I'll go through like you said, different kinds. Is it iPad in their hands or is the screen further away? And is it always after school or is it on the weekends?
Right.
And, you know, are they also, you know, are they starving and they'll come home and play video games before they have their snack? Is the snack next to them and they're not eating it, right? There's a lot of things, questions I'll go from a dysregulated perspective.
Yeah, for sure. And especially with screens, I mean, it can really depend, like, what kind of game are they playing? Are they playing something that has like a really finite ending? Are they playing something like Minecraft where you're super engrossed and it's very open-ended and it's really hard to get out, right? So it can really depend. You can get really in the weeds on it. But I kind of think like backward. I feel like what I often hear is, the transition out. That's where I hear
Yes.
most people talking about it being
Yeah.
really hard is the transition out.
Yes.
So, okay, if you start just there, then it's like, okay, what are we currently doing to aid the transition? Like, are we giving a warning? And if not, could we be, right? And if we are giving a warning, could we change it to be maybe a little more aware of whatever they're doing, right? So if they
Sure.
are, if my kid's playing like a racing game, instead of saying 5 minutes, like 5 minutes is actually kind of meaningless in the context of
Sure.
racing.
Yeah,
So
that's right.
instead, I'll say, you have time for one more race, one
Okay.
more race,
Sure.
right? And so that I can kind of make it a little more defined
Sure.
for kids, because even if they can tell time in
It's,
the
yeah.
They're not paying attention to the
Yeah,
clock,
and
right?
even
You
if
can
there's a
say
timer,
five
it doesn't
minutes.
help. But how do you do that for
Right.
like open-ended games, like you said? And I'm not
Yeah.
familiar with a lot of video games. My daughter plays like two things. So if
Yeah.
you could speak on that.
Yeah, for sure. So, in an open-ended game, what I think can be really helpful is, depending on the age of the kid and depending on, their personality, we could say, like, what is the last thing you want to do? You have time to do one more thing. What is the last thing you're going to do? Or you have time to reach a stopping place. What's your stopping place going to be? And for kids who like Minecraft especially, you can get very engrossed in a project. And I actually draw a lot of comparisons to school because, often at school you might be working on a really big project and you kind of come and go from day to day and you have to get to like stopping points along the way. And it's really similar in that same idea. You're working on this huge project
Oh,
that you're
yeah.
building or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it reminds me of my daughter. We have this ongoing like 500 piece puzzle and it's just
Oh,
out there and we
yeah.
can always go back to it. And then I'll be stuck and I'll be like verbally saying, I'm like, I think I'm going to have to stop here. I think I've had enough for today. I don't think I'm going to finish Snow White's dress today. I'll have to come back tomorrow. Like I will audibly say it out loud, but it is a hard
Yes.
stopping point when you're like, I really wanted to finish the dress, but
Yes.
it's like 20 minutes past.
The modeling is huge. I don't think people you can I don't think you can model enough. And modeling the feeling, right? You don't have to literally play a video game. It's that's it's the feeling of like, I want to get this done and I have to go make dinner. So I'm going to put this piece right here because this is the piece I'm working on. So the next time I come over, I remember this is where I left off. So it could be like I do this in video games. Like I'm playing a lot of Zelda at the moment, which is very open. And I will literally like leave myself at where whatever I'm trying to do next, right? I'll park myself outside of something so that
How to remember where you're
if
at.
it's 2 weeks later, I'll pick it up and go, oh, okay, this is what I'm doing. And so with kids, it's like, okay, what do you want to keep doing when you come back? Okay, how can we put you in a place where you remember that tomorrow? And you could even literally write it on a sticky note. First thing tomorrow, you're going to mine for iron. I'm trying to be Minecraftian.
I don't know
And
what it
then
means,
you,
but I'll go with it.
right. And you literally like put it on the switch, like stick it on there. Okay, great. This is what you're doing tomorrow. So giving them a reminder of like, we can leave this here because we know how to return to it. Giving a warning that is incorporating the style of what they're playing. The other thing, particularly if the difficulty with transitions is that it feels a little like boundary pushing, like maybe you said, hey, you have 5 minutes, and then they start something that will obviously take more than 5 minutes, and then they're like, oh, well, I'm not done yet,
Done.
right? Then what I will sometimes do is I will say, like, you have 3 minutes. Do you think, like, if you start a new race right now, you will not have time to finish? So do you want to stop in the middle of a race, or do you want to do something that will only take 3 minutes? So then I'm making clear, like, we are ending in 3 minutes. And
Yes, whether you
it's
like it or
up to
not.
you, right? It's up to you if we end in the middle of something or at the end of something. And I know that's really hard. Like, don't get me wrong. It is really hard. But some of it is, working with them to find ways of ending that and also making it clear that the end is still the end. And the other last thing I'll say is having a really clear thing planned for after. And that doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be like fun. Like our screen time is always right before dinner.
Yeah.
So it's like we go straight from that into dinner, and I know my kid and my kid's personality. So if I can just tell that they're going to have a harder time, mm-hmm. I know that I can always get them to the table if we race to the table, right?
Sure.
If I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to get dinner on the table and you have a race and I don't know if I'm going to win. And like
every time we all know our kids go to a spot
or I'll feign ignorance on how to turn the controller off. Like, oh my gosh, I have no idea how to turn this off. Do you know how? And then all of a sudden they get to show us something and they're so much smarter.
They
than
love
we
that.
Are.
My daughter loves pretending to control me as the character, but she has to like push me. Like I'm like, which
genius.
Way? And she'll like move my button, getting some heavy sensory input. Like she loves that.
So good.
So let's follow that through though. So for other families who then they set the boundary and, you know, you have 3 minutes, you can do this, and they don't go through it. Have you ever had to, or do you recommend parents actually remove the controller out of their hand, unplug it from the TV, completely turn off the TV? Like, is that the next course of action?
Again, you know your kid and you can probably tell if this is like a repeating behavior or mm-hmm. if this is a one-off, right? There are going to be times, like certain games now, like you genuinely can't save in the middle of something. You really will lose progress. And like, again, if your child is trying this every single day, then that might be a behavior you're trying to stop.
Sure.
If it really seems like a one-off, then
yeah,
you might be flexible in that moment, knowing it's not going to be forever. But if this is something happening recurring and you don't want it to be happening anymore, then yeah, I mean, depends how hard you want to go in. But yeah, the way we tend to phrase it is, would you like to turn it off or should I?
Yeah.
You know, and it's still their choice, but the choice there's no no, right?
Yeah.
There's no abstention as an option, right?
Exactly.
You can do it or I will do it. And in the past, mostly when my child was younger, like, yes, there were some we're wrenching it out of your hand moments. Mm-hmm. And does that feel good in the moment? Absolutely not.
No way.
But if you were to ask me, like, what's the thing I had to do that the most with, you know, like physically removing my child from something when it's hard. Like, honestly, it's probably a three-way tie between the grocery store and video games and playgrounds, right?
Yeah.
We all have those things that are really hard to like remove them from.
Sure.
And that's not the fault of those things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be the trigger of those things, but it's not the cause.
100%.
It might be the thing that's setting it off, but it is not the underlying cause.
Yeah.
The underlying cause is it's hard to stop fun things.
Yeah.
It's hard to
and
stop
you
doing
would
things
argue
we like.
That you need more practice doing that rather than taking it away. Right?
Exactly.
So, like, oh, play dates are so hard for you. I'm never taking you on a play date. That actually
would
never
help.
Teach your child the skill of that.
Absolutely. And if they struggled to leave the playground, we wouldn't say, I'm never taking you here again.
Right. But again,
that
goes with the morality of parents defining screen time as a privilege and like, you get to do this. You don't have to have this. So I'm taking it away. And that's when it goes down that cycle.
Right. And if you don't want to hold, if you are tired of having to have that power struggle, like, I'm not saying that no one should have no screen time. Like, if that is easier for your family, and go for it.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yes.
But for most families, there's a need for that in some way. And so I seeing it as something that like, yes, we're still going to have this be part of our lives. And so, yes, this is just something that needs more practice. And I, in those tough moments where I'm like, oh, I'm really having to hold a boundary around this. I haven't had to do this in like months or for real.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Then, like you said, it helps for me to just think like, okay, this skill is not all the way formed yet. Like this skill is not all the way developed yet. And today they need my help with it.
Yes. Yeah. For families who maybe are starting screen time for the first time or have decided, you know what, I do want to use this as a tool. I need to integrate this. Do you have any sort of, for you personally, like a checklist or things that you look at when you're looking for the right game, the right show, the right screen time thing? Like, do you have like a somewhat of a filter that you can share with us for parents who just don't know where to start? I'm the same. I'm like, I think she could use a different game at this point, but I don't even know what's out there. And I don't feel like playing all of the games, to be honest, to test them out.
Yeah, that is hard because some, like, one of the easiest ways is to play it a bit. And I totally get why people don't want to do
And so
that.
I'll insert one other thing. Even if I did want to play it, I don't quite know what I'm looking for.
Looking for. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I know when I see a game like Pock Pock, our favorite,
right.
I'm like, this is great. Like, this is a thing. Like, but it's unless it's that obvious, I don't know more of the red flags, so to speak, about games
for
to look
sure.
out for or screen. So if you have a general kind of list or filter that you want to call out of things to look for, would be helpful.
Yeah. So the irony is that I think a lot of caregivers are quick to say yes to or download games that are free. Totally get it because they're free. However, the problem with that is that if a game is free, like let's think from the game company's perspective, they're not making the game free out of altruism, right?
Yeah.
they are making the game free because but they still want to make money. So like, how is that a good business model, right?
Right.
And the way it's a good business model is that they do what's called microtransactions or ads. Like they just run a ton of ads. The problem with ads is they're unregulated. Even if a game is approved for a three-year-old, the ads are very often not approved for the same age bracket. So that is its own issue. And then often those ads are for other, not particularly well-made free games. And so then you get into this cycle of like, but this one's free, this one's free. And then endlessly downloading trash, you know?
Okay.
So that's one thing. But microtransactions are exactly what they sound like. They're these really small, you know, $1, $2, $3 payments to gain access to something else in the game. And totally depends on the game. Some of them are not necessarily predatory, you know, it might be like play levels 1 to 99 for free, but if you want more than that, you pay, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty obvious. But other games kind of give you the feeling that if you actually want to do well, or if you actually want to have fun, you'd have to spend money. Fortnite is probably the most famous example of this. If you don't pay for Fortnite, you can't save your character. You can't customize your character. Oh. You get different amounts of in-game currency every day when you log in. So there's tons of almost hierarchical incentives to pay. And the reason this is really important is that psychologically, these are motivating in two different, very different ways. If I pay for a game, I give them my $30 or whatever for a video game, they have my money. So they have to make me happy to have spent it, right? So that I don't demand a refund and so that I buy the next one. And so that motivation tends to be more intrinsic. They make me feel competent. Mm-hmm. They make me feel in control. They make me maybe feel like I can relate to other people. The game feels fully developed. And now I'm feeling just like good about myself and I'm having a good time because I'm feeling accomplished. But a game that's free doesn't make me want to feel that way. If they make me feel that way, I'll never buy anything. That's not a good business model. So instead, they make me feel like I would be having a little bit more fun or an easier time or a better time if I just spent money. And so that is what we call an extrinsic motivator, which is like a reward. And really in gaming, really that's more like gambling, especially because sometimes it'll be like, oh, well, this sword will make you invincible. And then you get it and actually it's not that great. And now you spent your money and that you kind of got that hit. And now you're like, but now I'd have to spend more. And so now all of your attention is on the money spending piece. And
the dopamine hits.
Yeah. And so free to play games are ones that we tend to avoid.
Okay.
And if you are unsure if it's kind of a less predatory one or a more predatory one, if you look at the fine print, like in the App Store, if you kind of scroll to the bottom, some games will have this disclaimer where it will say like there are, I can't remember the phrasing. It's something like there are random variables or like there are, you know, purchases in this game may be like random. And that's basically saying like,
Yep, a slot machine.
it's slot machine
It's a slot
essentially.
machine.
Yeah. If you are wanting an easy way to find games that are not going to be structured that way, on Apple iOS, they have something called Apple Arcade. And Apple Arcade, it's like $5 a month. It's really cheap. And there is a Google equivalent. I just can't remember what it's called for Android. And
That's
for a
okay.
game to be available in Apple Arcade, it cannot have ads and it cannot have microtransactions. So that like immediately makes the pool a lot, like, you know, if you're in there, you're like, okay, well, at least I've weeded those out before I even start. That's really helpful.
I did not know that. That's great.
And you can often find like a free, like I have Verizon and I got 6 months of it for free. So you might even have like an incentive to try it for a bit and see if you like it. And then within there, you can filter by age and then you can get a better sense. The other thing is, Common Sense Media has a ton of reviews of apps and video games and shows. And I really like them because they are not, it's not just like, oh, it's good for ages 5 and up, right? It's very specific. It'll say like, this has this kind of portrayal of friendship, or it portrays, you know, this kind of name calling or this kind of interpersonal conflict. And it also allows reviews from caregivers and from kids, which I also like, because then you can kind of get a wraparound sense of what something is like. So I think those are some good ways to kind of get started if you're unsure.
To filter it down.
For
That's
sure.
really
And then if
helpful.
you're really looking for a video game, you can always look for like kids always want to watch people playing them on YouTube,
Oh,
but
that's
you can use that to
right.
your advantage.
That's
Like you could
right.
watch somebody
To
play
see
it.
what it's like. I rely on YouTube to prepare my kid for what everything is like. So why not do that for a
Yeah,
video
for
game?
yourself.
Last question I kind of want to ask, because I hear this a lot. Parents will tend to, if they're start, if they're like, okay, we will do iPad, but it has to be an educational and academic app. And so they will just search, and there's like a few big ones, right, that we know of that, sure, they're teaching your kid like reading skills and math skills, maybe, but there's a lot of extra microtransactions. There's a lot of extra rewards and tokens that come from every time they pass this level. And then there's a lot of really not the best feelings when you get an answer wrong and it has a big X when you get it wrong. Like there's a lot of other things that come with it. That I wish parents knew more about what we're considering educational, which you can get from an open-ended app, and all of the executive functioning skills and the social skills you can learn, and the reading skills from reading the little, their narratives and the stuff. So what's your spiel to parents who are maybe focusing too much on trying to try like those academic, those like educational labeled apps versus trying something else that might be more unconventional, but still equally as valuable?
Oh yeah, I would actually argue more valuable, to be honest. So here's what I'll say. Academic apps or games, who is the target audience? And I will argue the target audience is not children. The target audience is the adult. Because a kid's not going to decide to download and pay for academic app of your choice. An adult is going to do that. So the game does not have to appeal to kids. It has to appeal to adults. So it is convincing the adult that the child is learning. It is not necessarily actually centering what the child needs. And so even the tasks that a kid will do, they are tasks that an adult will recognize as educational. Like you, the adult is the audience for that. And the problem is that real involved critical thinking is often invisible, right? We recognize that with like independent play. We'll talk about how independent play is so important because of all the things they're learning. But those are often things that, frankly, are kind of hard to recognize if you aren't looking for them. You know, a kid playing with blocks, and you know, we don't necessarily look at that and go like, Oh, well, clearly they know how to make a cylinder, right? I'm like, no, they couldn't identify a cylinder in a geometry test, but they are building spatial reasoning and they're building
Sure.
cause and effect, and those
Right.
are critical thinking skills. And without those
Yeah.
skills, the surface level, quote unquote, academic things like knowing what a cylinder is, those things really are meaningless unless you have the foundational understanding that comes from critical thinking. So an academic app that might be asking kids to, match lowercase letters to their uppercase pairs, for example, a child could do that and they could get every single one wrong and until they eventually just kind of get it right by accident.
Yep.
And in that case, it's like, okay, what have they learned?
Yep.
And the answer is, well, they haven't technically learned anything. They have reinforced what they
Yep.
already knew or what they already didn't know, right? If they
Uh-huh.
didn't know it, they probably don't know it any better now. They
Yeah.
just have kind of like gotten through it. So I totally get why we want our screen time to feel quote unquote valuable. My 5 second soapbox on that would be everyone deserves leisure, including kids. And it's okay if screens are just leisure, everybody deserves leisure. That said, when we recognize that there could be deeper involved critical thinking going on in the entertainment games our kids like to play, we can help make those connections. If I see their use of a screen, even if it's being done for leisure, if I see it as valid, then I'm suddenly allowing myself to notice the things in it that connect to the rest of their lives. So if I notice they're building something in Minecraft and it looks just like a park by our house, well, now I can talk to them about where'd you get that idea? And like,
Yep.
I noticed that, the tree was the right size compared to the bench or whatever. And then the next time they're struggling with something in another part of their life, I can maybe draw a connection. I can say, okay, when you decided to build this in Minecraft, how did you decide how to start? What did you do first? And bring in that same set of skills into the rest of their lives. And then they are realizing, the kids are realizing that they have those abilities
Yeah.
and they're able to make that gap and bridge that gap. And then it becomes a place for connection instead of a place for contention and power struggle. And that doesn't mean we're saying it's the best thing they do with their time, but we can recognize its validity, and that allows us to connect with them over it and maybe use it to bridge into other things.
Such a good way to end out this episode, just like every other parenting, every other child behavior or challenge we come across, the answer always ends up like the first part is like changing our mindset shifts. What is important to us? Why do we care about it so much? Can we let go of certain things? And all of a sudden, things that you were defining as a problem are no longer a problem. And it's just so liberating. And you're like, wait, I don't actually have to worry about that. So I find parents need more explicit permission of things that you're saying. Let your kid play the things that bring them joy. Experience the joy with them, get in their world and use that outside of the outside of the video games. I see more and more parents now trying to get into Pokemon world and trying to really learn. I would have loved if my parents actually sat and let me talk to them about Little House on the Prairie books, but like they didn't want to hear it. So I try really hard when my daughter will like show me something random that I don't get on her game, but I'll just try really hard to listen. But it brings up so much opportunity for
For
connection.
sure. For sure.
Before you go, I would love if you let everyone know again where to find you, maybe some exciting things that we can find on your page, on your Instagram page, and any other resources that you want to share with us for parents trying to navigate the world of screens.
Yeah, and thanks so much for having me. It was so nice to talk to you. And I live mostly on Instagram at The Gamer Educator. And there you can find all things screens and management and these kind of reframes. And I do have a website, thegamereducator.com. Not a ton on there, but I do have some longer form guides for families that can be really helpful. Things like, setting up and using Switch and Kindle devices. And also, I have several long guides about YouTube. It didn't come up in our conversation, but YouTube is often something that parents are really concerned about of how to make sure it's safe. It is not instinctual, but there are so many ways you can actually make YouTube really locked down for kids. Cool. So I have several posts about that that you can find on my website. And yeah, I'm happy to help however I can. Thanks for having
Great.
Me.
Thank you for being here, Ash. I'll talk to you soon.
Alrighty.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider rating it and leaving a review, which helps other parents find me as well. Want to learn more from me? I share tons more over on Instagram @TheOTButterfly. See you next time.